A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T. Heyity, 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 ho, and welcome to episode 50-something, 2, 3 of P, Q, R, S, T. We will get to the next couple chapters of The Kid in a moment, but first, just to catch you up, my lovely wife and beautiful son and I just had a road trip, golly, all over the northwestern United States, 10 states, Colorado, Montana, Idaho, Washington, Nevada, Utah, California, Oregon, and two other, Wyoming, and a little bit of Arizona. Hey, 10 states. And I'm not going to tell you all about the road trip because what do you care? But while we were on the road trip, here's the part where, if you're listening to this podcast, you might find this interesting. On the road trip, we listened to The Kid in its entirety. And I'm very grateful to my lovely wife, Tiffany, for being willing to sit there for hours and hours of my voice. I mean, we've already established I like the sound of my own voice very much, but she endured quite a bit of it on the trip as we not only listened to The Kid, but also Farmer Boy that I had recorded, the chapters that made it. Three of the chapters had disappeared somehow, and I had to re-record them a few minutes ago. But also 12 Years in the Saddle, the LibriVox recording that I did, and we were even poised to listen to Seeing Darkly, the other LibriVox recording I've done, but ran out of road. So anyway, back to The Kid. It was very interesting. I'm sure I told you guys on this podcast that as I was recording it, kept running across characters that I'd forgotten about 17 years ago, ran across an entire plot twist, which we're not going to get to today. We'll be just on the cusp of it, but you'll have to come back in 2 weeks for that. Plot twist that I had completely forgotten about, and I was like, oh my goodness. But most of it, how do I say this? As I was recording, I was really kind of, I wasn't sure. I was questioning the whole idea is, I don't know if this book is all that good, I'm not sure. And it's interesting that it's a completely different experience to listen to something that I had just recorded. I mean, arguably, I would think, well, you just read Farmer Boy, you know, 3 weeks ago, now you're listening to Farmer Boy. You're probably going to tune out most of it and concentrate on the road. But when I'm recording, I'm concerned about whether or not the camera's still functioning, how's the microphone, is there enough battery life, is there enough tape left, is the cat going to make any noise, is the dog going to make any noise, is the baby going to make noise, is that motorcycle that just went by on the street going to be a problem? So there's a lot to think about, and also the voices that I'm doing and whose voice is coming up next, reading ahead a couple of sentence or two to try not to get tripped up by an unexpected voice or song or something. And so I'm not really paying attention to the material, which I admit sounds weird to say. But then on the road trip, while we sat there and listened to it, I could just get into the story. And I did get into the story. There were a couple things, Jason's interactions with Raven, Raven's interactions with a member of his family, Jason's interactions with a member of his family that's coming up fairly soon. There were a couple things that I wanted to really listen to just to see if they would hold together. And it's a good book, if I do say so myself, and I admit that I am, but I'd be willing to sit here and say, you know, this one's not so great. It's a good book, and to be able to listen to it and kind of separate myself from having been the guy that wrote it because it's been so long, I'm proud. I'm proud of that book. I'm proud of having written it, and you guys are in for a treat because the ending, well, we got a couple episodes before we get there, but things get pretty interesting. Hopefully they've already been interesting, but they keep going, and things are about to ramp up. And so, I will also say that my wife did me a huge compliment. She said at the end of it, she's like, that was good. Her exact words, something on the order of that if this was a book on Amazon, which it's going to be, she would have given it a 4 out of 5, and that she very rarely gives anything a 5. A 5 is like something that she can absolutely cannot put down. She's so engrossed in it. She's like, it's not a 5, but it's definitely a 4. And she's not the sort to blow smoke in my ear. She wouldn't say things like that just to make me feel good. She's an honest woman. So that meant a lot. And after we finished, she said, you know, you should be proud of yourself. And I am. So anyway, with that build up, why don't we listen to a couple more chapters? See if Raven and Jason can figure out their problems, huh? Well, here we go. Chapter 12. For Jason Stiller, the season wound up again, as opposing teams stepped up to the plate and fell right back, defeated, and the pennant race came down to the wire. Somehow almost a month went by, and the final games were suddenly just around the corner before Raven and Jason came face to face again. For him it was a complete surprise, though a possibly happy one. For her, Raven had come to the ball field hoping to see him, hoping to tell him what had happened. It was like being in love. In fact, it was such a higher thing than she had known before that Raven had begun wondering if she had ever really been in love. But to be held by the touch, by the word of someone who would never leave nor forsake her, who had loved her while she was a sinner and deserved nothing from his holy will. There were still desires in her. There was still a hope that the baseball player with the tousled brown hair and enchanting brown eyes would maybe give her another chance, now that she was learning how worthy of love she was. Gertrude had mentioned, after one of the church services Raven had shared with her, the bit about unequally yoked. Raven could understand that. But she had, after all, seen Jason Stiller bow his head for a few grace before meals. It was not very much to go on. Maybe it was nothing more than a standard tradition. But maybe it meant Jason knew Jesus, too, and maybe that meant there was common ground between them. Maybe they could start over. Praying to the Lord of her life was something that she was definitely going to need to practice, but Gertie had said that it wasn't so important to get the words right, but rather to speak from her heart. While she waited on the Muldowney's porch swing for the men of the house to get home from the latest ball game, Raven could and did remember another summer evening that was somehow both not so long ago and ancient, so far back as to be almost unthinkable. Remembering sitting on the porch swing next to him, remembered the wonderful surprise of his warm hand clasping hers. But she didn't need that. Opening her unknowingly striking green eyes, Raven watched life go by on the quiet street and thought about it. There was no use wanting to go back to the way things had been. That was impossible and hadn't worked anyhow. And she had just given her life over to another. Hopefully there was still the possibility for romance, for caresses and kisses and all those wonderful feelings, but still, in the end, he was all she needed. Raven bit her lip and hoped that she would be able to believe that and act accordingly. Just remembering that oh-so-recent kiss sent a familiar ache through her heart, the same heart which her Lord had made new. On top of that was the black cloud on the horizon, the cloud that threatened a nasty storm, as her father had made it plain that he was looking earnestly for a well-financed, well-respected man who was in the market for a beautiful, gracious owner's daughter. Then there was no time for anything but a quick prayer as the black Chevrolet eased up to the curb and the two Boston Braves stepped out. At least he looked glad to see her. Jason had not expected to see Raven and knew somehow that she was there to see him. That suddenly the thrill of winning the first game in the league championship was gone, replaced with a sudden anxiety, with a thousand racing thoughts. He hoped against hope that she would forgive him, that the unreasoning fears had gone away, that there was still hope for them after everything. DG smiled and spoke to his goddaughter for a moment or two, and then slipped inside, leaving Raven and Jason alone on the front porch as the sun began to set. "Hi." "Hello." Sort of a dumb beginning, but Raven had rarely felt so nervous, and it didn't help that she couldn't read his eyes. Would he listen? "Haven't seen you for a while." "I guess not. How's the baseball life?" "It's nice to be back on the team again. We won today." "Good news." But she wasn't there to talk about baseball. "Congratulations. You and Bud are friends, then?" "As much as we're likely to be, I guess. At least we're working together now." He sat down on the swing, and she sat next to him, suddenly unsure of how close to be. She kept some distance, just to be safe.
"That's good."
A pause. "I'm sorry, Raven. I shouldn't have yelled at you, and I didn't really mean the things I said."
"I forgive you. I'm sorry for hurting you."
"It wasn't your fault."
"Still."
Another pause.
It's funny you mentioned Bud, because I guess I've changed a bit in the past month, and I've been thinking about us a lot. Would she even listen? What would she say? Had enough time passed that the fears she hadn't understood had become resolved, or at least gone back wherever they came from? I've changed, too. You wouldn't believe it. He didn't understand the look in her eyes. It was happiness, it was joy, but it was not something he had seen before. He fervently hoped it was at least partly because he was there. I just thought that maybe if we could go back, just start from where things made sense, and... Jason, do you know Jesus? Huh? A silent moment passed. Sure, sort of. What was he supposed to say to that? He didn't look like he was getting it. I've just been, well, introduced, you might say. Gertie and I had a long talk a while back, and I got saved. Congratulations. Now he wouldn't meet her eyes. Wasn't he happy for her? Wasn't this a wonderful thing? Didn't Jason care at all? Well, don't you care? Jason, this is the most wonderful thing that ever happened to me. Don't you care about me at all? A long pause. Jason, I thought that I meant something to you, and this is the most wonderful thing that has ever happened to me, she repeated. Why is it always about you? Why are you the only one who gets to be important? But Jason, this is so much more than just baseball. If you just listen, you know what was the most wonderful thing to happen to me? Now he was looking at her, and she suddenly wished he wouldn't. His eyes were still hard, still pained. You, Raven. Then you decided to strip that away for reasons I still don't understand. Maybe you should ask Jesus to make me understand, but I don't have it in me to throw a parade. He hadn't meant to say that. He hadn't meant to say any of it, and if she was happy, he wanted to be happy for her. But it just wasn't something he could do. Not that evening. It's been a long day, and I don't really feel like listening to you talk about yourself. Inwardly, he cursed his own mouth, but his teeth wouldn't stay closed. I'm sure you're welcome to stay for supper. Then the front screen door slammed, and Raven was again alone on the front porch. What in the world had just happened? All she had tried to do was tell Jason the good news. All she had wanted to do was share with him the wonderful things that God had done for her, and he'd acted like a spoiled brat? It didn't make sense. It didn't match the man she knew was inside somewhere. Raven pushed her tears away, and just despite him, she did stay for supper and chatted gaily with Gertrude, ignoring the brat as much as was possible. Only once she was safely home did she cry bitterly. Boston Tribune, column copy, KG, editor-in-chief, R.Y. That was some week, by Kip Gumbo. Goodness gracious, baseball fans far and wide. Whether or not you really have a deep-seated love for the Braves, or for that matter, Boston itself, if you care anything for the greatest sport in all creation, then you must have been glued to the radio for the past 5 days. But in the unlikely event that this bit of newsprint finds you in a cave or beyond the reach of electricity, I will do my best to recount the National League championship the rest of us are still recovering from. The Braves had been making quite a showing of themselves, especially once the in-team difficulties between a player or two got themselves ironed out. Yet they went into the five-game series with more than a little humility and wariness, knowing, as we all did, that the Illinois Reds had handed them a straight-up, straight-down, three-game loss the last time our hometown heroes and the pride of Springfield went bat-to-bat. I regret that mere newsprint is nowhere near sufficient to express the drive, the absolute determination, the acts of heroism from every member of the Boston Braves. Certainly there were major battles won courtesy of the team's stars, from Dutch Gatan, Bud Triplehorn, Sam Washington, but as I've said, every member of the Braves was called upon to deliver his best. Thus we have rookie Ted Conroy, not only hitting several important home runs, but also squaring off with a yard of Boston dirt in his zeal to catch a ball that was sailing past second base. And Phil Broice, also in his first season as a Brave and a major leaguer, sending a surprise line drive right past Johnny Porter, the Reds' second baseman, to tie up game two. And what of the third rookie, the young man who has not undeservedly accepted the most interest, the most accolades in the past summer? Ah, the kid pulled through in flying colors.
though not in a way that his fans might have expected. If you remember, the first game came and went solidly on the side of the Braves, and then after Phil's single in Game 2 made for a tie game, Sammy Washington knocked one out of the park to wrap it all up. The Reds found some extra gumption somewhere, perhaps it arrived on a later train, because they came back and came back fierce to edge out the Braves in Game 3 and completely dominate Game 4, pitcher Lee Harper holding even Jason Stiller to but one RBI. And so for Game Number 5, things came down to the finest of wires, even to the end of the ballgame itself. Both teams came out hungry for a win, playing the best sport they had in them, and if the previous struggles had brought out good playing, if the recent days had seen acts of bravery and sacrifice for the sake of the game, this final contest, as I have said, cannot be described in mere newsprint. When the Reds scored, the Braves came up with a run of their own. When Triplehorn sent a batter packing, Hopper matched with three strikes for his team. As you most certainly know, the Reds have their own star hitter, Frank Kussler, and this man went bat for bat against the kid, and it was a tie game going into the bottom of the ninth inning. The clouds were forming thickly. The crowds had quieted, holding their breath, as Jason the Kid Stiller went to bat for his Braves with two outs and a man on third. Not that the man on third mattered two hoots, or at least that's what everybody who was there was thinking. The contest was between Hopper and Stiller, whether or not the best pitcher in the National League could once again short sheet the greatest batter in baseball history. You don't believe me? Watch this young man's career and see if it ain't true. I'm not the only one saying it. And one excellent, amazing reason why has little to do with distance, with speed, with force from a bat to a ball. A lot has to do with heart and teamwork and the way Jason Stiller handled the splintering fastball Lee Harper shot at him. The kid bunted. What? You say. What? 33,000 people at the stadium and hundreds of thousands listening over the radio said. The kid followed the signal his manager gave him, choked up on a bat just at the last instant, quite a feat in itself, and bunted, the ball rolling gently towards a spot right between the pitching mound and first base. I think we have the shrewd mind of Dennis G. Muldowney to thank for that brilliant and daring play. Had anybody else bunted, the Reds would have been prepared for it, would have scooped up the ball, and quite possibly, it is the pennant championship after all, these teams have some skill, making a nice if unnecessary double play to get batter and runner out, making it four outs and game definitely over. Since it was the kid, well, we can forgive the Reds and the rest of the baseball-loving world for not ever, in their wildest dreams, expecting a bunt. And you know the rest, Slugger fans. Both Hopper and first baseman Seafoot took a good 2-3 seconds to comprehend what had just happened, and right about then, Bill Pickens crossed home plate and the Boston Braves had won the pennant. Just goes to show you how dangerous a thing it is to assume you know what something else is thinking. Although we do have the World Series coming up in less than a week. And personally, I don't believe there's going to be a whole lot of bunting going on. End. Jason Stiller had seen firsthand the extent of Bud Triplehorn's pitching ability, despite what the man himself said about his talents. What the kid had not expected to discover was just how much water his teammate could displace when performing one of his patented cannonballs. After sewing up the championship victory over the Reds, DG was more than willing to allow his players a little fun. With the World Series only a short week away, he told his boys that he had a good tonic in mind, a way to both celebrate the win and loosen up for the greater trial to come. All but the rookies knew about the lake, the same quiet spot the Braves visited at the close of every summer. Oh, but to leave off the end of the diving platform as a winner, splashing about with one's buddies, making raucous fools of yourselves, with a taste of victory in your souls and in the back of your minds at the same time, it was magnificent. More than one teammate congratulated Jason personally and mentioned how nice it was to have him be a part of things, and in the end, the kid was embarrassed. And he made an extra apology to both DG and Bud Triplehorn about things past, finally understanding what his childishness had almost cost. They accepted graciously, and then Bud dumped Jason into the water, quickly following the rookie in thanks to a healthy assist from the manager of the Braves. It was silly and juvenile, and the Boston Braves had never enjoyed an afternoon so much ever before. After getting dunked by his loving teammates so many times that Jason would have been better off with gills, he begged off and climbed out of the water to sit on the dock with his friend Phil for a time. Phil Bryce had proven himself to be a solid outfielder, a fair hitter, and a good friend. But the poor guy did have one failing. He couldn't swim. "So I'll teach you," Jason offered, as soon as this was disclosed. "I don't know, Jace. It looked like you were having enough trouble staying above water." The kid laughed, hitting the side of his head to get the extra water out of his ear. After checking the doc to make sure he hadn't lost any of his brains in the process, Jason encouraged, "Well, that was sort of a war, Phil. I was planning on teaching you during peacetime." He waved a vague hand at a more quiet corner of the lake. "Someplace a little less boisterous." "I don't know. I'll think about it." "Fair enough." That settled, Jason leaned back to absorb a ray or two of sunshine. He knew his fellow rookie well enough to see that there was more on Phil's mind than a lack of swimming ability. But Bryce was not one to be drawn out. Either he spoke his mind or he didn't, and the only way Jason would find out which would occur was just to wait patiently. And that day, it was spoken. "I thought I was nervous before the championship, but man, the butterflies are doing cartwheels now, you know?" Jason thought about it, and could at least imagine, though he wasn't feeling the same thing at all. "Well, just think of it as another couple of baseball games, Phil. That's all it is to me."
"Really?"
"Pretty much. Well, I want to win, certainly, but what makes it more special than any other game in the end?" Phil had apparently been thinking about that more than a little. "The pressure, the fact that it's the biggest, the fact that it's the last chance, the money involved, the number of people in the stands and listening at home. There's even talk of getting at least one of the games on television." Jason had seen a television in Boston. He'd been forced to ask what it was. "That stupid toy?" He yawned. "Like anybody will ever really waste their time staring at a little screen." "Hey, haven't you always said you wished you could see what was going on when we listened to games on the radio?" "I don't know, maybe it'll be something. But anyway, you heard my reasons before you interrupted," he finished, not unkindly. "I heard him. You're probably right, too, but it's just another game, really. On top of that, the Mets just barely managed to top out their league. It's not the same as facing off against the Reds at all, and you know it." He punched his friend on the shoulder. "You'll see. It'll be a cakewalk." "If you think so, that's enough for me, kid. That's the spirit." With a sudden burst of energy, Jason got to his feet. "Come on, enough stalling." "Huh? You're going to learn how to swim, Goliath, and no excuses." There were excuses, but in the end, Phil agreed that if he were ever on a sinking ocean liner, not that there were many of those in Boston proper, he might just find the ability to swim sort of handy. And Jason proved himself to be a fairly patient teacher. As the two friends worked together, Phil actually took a fair stab at learning how to swim, despite swallowing at least half of the lake along the way. The women who agonized and worried after their Braves were also welcome at the celebration, and most of the players' wives and girlfriends came along, got to know one another better, and did their best to ignore how childish their individual men were being out in the water. In a modest, dark red bathing suit that she knew showed off her eyes, Raymond Germain sat next to Gertrude Muldowney and talked with her for a time. But all the while, her eyes never strayed very far from one Jason Stiller. Gertie hadn't had a lot of advice on the subject, except that she, Raven, should trust God to make things come out right, and be willing to let God do what he wanted, which might not involve Mr. Stiller at all. She could only make her heart pay attention to that. Raven wanted to get on with her life, wanted to just trust her Lord in all things, and she was getting better at it with practice. But just the sight of those brown eyes, the sound of his laugh, was enough to pull at her insides all over again. He was a good man. There was no denying that, as she watched him patiently work with Phil for several hours, without fanfare or recognition, much longer, in fact, than Raven herself would have bothered. By the time the afternoon began to wane, their time in the sun almost over, the two friends had given up the struggle, had gone back to their perch on the dock, Jason apparently willing to stay with his friend quietly, instead of jumping in with the hap crowd out in the water once more. Jason Stiller was a good man. But there were things in his past that he had never dealt with, and despite bowing his head at mealtimes, Jason seemed to care little for the things of God. Raven thought back over their last conversation, for the umpteenth time. And yet suddenly, as she listened not only to his responses, but also to her own, she really heard both sides for the first time. And it was awful. She hadn't listened to him any more than he had listened to her. She was just as much at fault for their argument as he was. Amazed at her selfishness and her pride and not being able to really see what had happened, Raven started to do what had been normal for so long. She began to put herself down, mentally, to berate the terrible person she was and always would be. But he had said she was better than that. He had said that he loved her and taught her how to forgive, even how to forgive herself. Come to think of it, he had also told her to forgive others. Perhaps Mr. Stiller deserved another chance. And maybe Raven could do a better job of being the Christian she was learning how to be. Deciding that she didn't, for once, want to put things off, Raven got to her feet, brushed away any clinging sand, and then started to walk towards the pier, hoping to maybe find a few minutes to speak with the man she loved. Just about then, the screaming began. Jason was also walking back to the dock, having gotten up to grab two bottles of Coca-Cola for himself and his friend, when across the water, out near the middle of the lake, someone began to yell like they were being killed. He recognized the voice as Bud Triplehorn's. Without much of a clue as to what was happening, Jason knew that the man was in serious trouble, and that was enough for him. The bottles of pop lay forgotten in the sand as the star hitter of the Boston Braves sprinted the length of the pier and leaped off the end, diving cleanly into the deep blue waters. Jason was both a strong swimmer and in pretty good shape. All the batting he had been doing hadn't hurt, and it didn't take long for him to stroke his way out to the sandbar in the middle of Lake Prickend, where the shouts were still coming from. He heard the hoarse cries for help as he crawled up onto the sand, but still couldn't see, Bud being on the other side. Gathering his strength, Jason quickly climbed up the low hill, bursting over the top, to see Bud Triplehorn doing his best to beat off the largest, meanest-looking snapping turtle Jason had ever seen or imagined. The thing was as large as a wolf and looked just as nasty, with blood-red eyes that sparked at Jason and a cruel, strong, sharp beak that was clamped firmly just below Bud's shoulder. There was little time to act and no time to think. On blind instinct, Jason raced down the hill towards the two combatants, grabbing up something sturdy and wooden he passed that later turned out to be an oar left behind by some long-ago lake mariner. Distinctly, above Bud's shouts for him to help, and the strange and raucous keen of the turtle, angry that his prey was putting up a fight, Jason could hear the sharp beak grating against the bones in Bud's arm. Then with a crack that echoed off the surrounding hills, Jason used up all the power he and gravity had to offer and brought the oar down hard on the huge turtle's head. And then he reared back in a split second to strike again, but there was no need. The beast seemed unhurt, though the oar had cracked in half from the blow. But despite taking no damage, the turtle made a piteous cry, let go his hold on the pitcher, and half stumbled, half fell back into the water. The last Jason saw of the thing, it was dazedly swimming towards the swampy far bank, apparently trying to come to grips with what had happened. But there was no time for stray thoughts just then. Bud was bleeding and whimpering in a way Jason wouldn't have imagined the man would ever do, which told him just how much pain his teammate was feeling. Hang on, Bud, we're not going to lose this one, okay? I just wanted to swim around the island, and the thing started chasing me. He seemed to be almost disinterested. The cries were quieting into something sort of numb, and though Jason knew nothing about people going into shock, he knew somehow that it was wrong. It was bad, and he had to keep Bud from going anyplace. Bud, stick around here, come on. It's gone, right? Biggest fluffer nut and turtle I ever saw, partner, biggest... And he trailed off, and looked about as dazed as the beast had. Francis Triplehorn, you look at me. It's gone. I'm here. Help is on the way. Jason had heard the shouts behind him and knew others were coming, but he couldn't go to them, couldn't leave his friend behind. And you're not going to worry about that stupid monster, okay? Look at me. It wasn't working. Jason gave it his last shot. You know, that stupid fastball of yours ain't nothing. Hear me, buddy? It ain't nothing. Bud blinked. Jason was watching, and it seemed like maybe something deep inside was reacting. You remember that first day? Day we met? I could have hit that ball to the moon, pal. Wasn't a guy out there, including Bob Germain, that couldn't have got a piece of that ball. Now the bigger man was just silent, but something deep in his eyes. Lousiest fastball of all time, you Triplehorn special. When his teammate suddenly growled at him, Jason sighed with relief and almost dropped the man. You say that again. Bud tried to move his arm and let out a short cry once he had. Gah! And I'll clobber you with the arm that is working, kid. Good to have you back, Bud. The man was not so happy to have returned to all of his pain. I wish I could say I liked being here. Is help on the way? Jason blinked back, sudden tears.
not knowing where they had come from.
You bet, buddy. Hang on.
It took rather a long time to get the closest rowboat out to the island, though between Jason and DG, the trip back took almost no time at all, the two men throwing all of their frustration and fear into hauling at the oars until their arms and shoulders ached. The bleeding was slowing, but hadn't stopped. DG and Jason, with the help of Dutch Catan and Bill Pickens, lifted Bud out of the boat and quickly carted him to where the team's cars had been parked.
"Who has the fastest?"
Jason wanted to know.
"Bob Germain," DG replied without hesitation.
The manager of the Braves, despite his player's wound and the fear pounding at his own heart's door, took a perverse pleasure in carting the groaning Triplehorn into the back of Germain's precious limousine.
"Get going, Richard."
Hearing the tone in DG's voice, the chauffeur didn't argue. The engine turned over smoothly, and within moments, the badly injured Brave was heading quickly for the nearest hospital. With nothing more to do, Dennis had sat back in his seat and closed his eyes, hearing rather than seeing Bud speak.
"What are you laughing at, rookie?"
Jason sounded embarrassed.
Not to insult you or anything, Bud, but I was just thinking of how pleased Bob's going to be when he sees the bloodstains in the back of the car here.
Everyone in the limo, the injured included, found the humor in that, although Bud then scolded Jason for making him laugh. With an effort, DG opened his eyes and helped keep things as light as possible, helped find the good news in the situation. During the entire long ride, no matter what was discussed or joked about, there was one thing every man in the car avoided mentioning, avoided even coming close to mentioning, no matter what. The fact that this stupid monster turtle had decided in its hunger or rage to clamp savagely onto Bud Triplehorn's arm.
His right arm.
Raven had driven with Gertrude out to the hospital. Gertie had gone to be with her husband, and Raven had gone just because she felt she should. Not that Jason would be happy to see her. Or would he? She had put the thought away, concentrating on the comfort and encouragement of Missy Triplehorn. The troubles of the afternoon had little to do with Raven. Finally, the doctor had come out to the assembly of players, players' wives, and owner's daughter. Dr. Carvery picked Mrs. Triplehorn out of the crowd immediately and put a hand on her shoulder.
"He's going to be just fine."
As if a sudden spell had been broken, the entire group sighed, relaxing a notch or two. Yet there was still anxiety, mostly reflected on the faces of the Braves. The doctor went on.
"I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to see this turtle. It must have been a real beast. Bud had lacerations on either side of his deltoid, and you can see bite marks traveling halfway down to his elbow. The biggest problem was the loss of blood, but we had more ready for just such an emergency, and his levels are up to normal. No bones broken, no ligaments torn." The doctor's voice slowed a bit. "Maybe some little tissue damage, but it shouldn't impede the use of his arm."
"Shouldn't?"
The question came from a worried-looking Dennis G. Muldowney. Dr. Carvery was a staunch Braves fan. He turned to DG and spoke the truth.
"I don't know, Mr. Muldowney, if his pitching will really survive this experience or not. As far as the actual damage goes, as far as my medical knowledge can say, there's no reason Bud can't be back to his own self in time for the upcoming series, even. But this shoulder, it's a tricky thing, and you want to keep an eye on it."
"Can he pitch or not?"
"You're Jason Stiller, right? Pleasure to meet you, son. Never seen such batting. To answer your question, well, son, I already have. Gave us a day or two of observation, get him some rest, and he should be, maybe, might be just fine. And that's all I can say."
Raven watched as the man she was in love with shook the doctor's hand, nodding. He didn't look happy. None of the men looked happy. She turned to Gertrude in exasperation, though she kept her voice down.
"Wasn't that good news? That he's going to be okay?"
She hadn't meant for it to happen, but DG heard the comment and answered before his wife could.
"It's great news, Coon, and don't think we're not all grateful that he's still alive. But the news that he maybe won't be a star pitcher anymore doesn't fill us with a lot of joy, all right?"
Raven knew she shouldn't argue, that it wasn't the time or place, but something in her got all fired up in a hurry.
"I think that's awful. He could have been killed out there today, and he's going to be okay, make a full recovery, and all you care about is your stupid baseball games? You don't care about him at all."
Everyone in the waiting room was looking at her, and nobody seemed to know what to say. Except the injured man's wife of 22 years.
"You don't understand, Raven. They all..."
And she stood and looked around at the assembled group. "To a man, care about my husband, and they understand how he would feel, what he would say. She lowered her voice, sounding actually quite a bit like Bud would, and it would have been funny, except that it wasn't.
My right arm's the only talent I got, Miss Germaine. Pitching's all I know. I can't do nothing else.
Raven wanted to protest that of course the man could do any one of a thousand jobs, but she knew, somehow, that this was beside the point.
I don't understand you people at all.
Missy sat down again, looking resigned rather than upset. DG stood and looked the owner's daughter right in the eye, his expression not unkind.
It's about dreams, Raven. If that arm doesn't get all better, if he can't hack it anymore, then all of his dreams have been stripped away.
Then maybe he's got the wrong dreams, Dennis.
She snapped at him, and felt good for doing so.
Maybe they are, Raven.
He didn't look upset, at least not with her. The look in his eyes was more pitying, a pity for her that she couldn't understand. The waiting room was absolutely quiet, save for a distant PA speaker calling some doctor or other. Raven looked around at all of the faces there, all of the people who had shown up to be concerned for Bud Triplehorn. Her father not among them, of course, having something more important to do. And she tried to find a face she could talk to, find someone who would understand, and only Gertrude Muldowney offered her a little sad smile that said volumes, that said she knew what Raven was feeling. It wasn't much comfort, not in the midst of such madness. Finally, after almost a full minute of staring at him, the kid consented to look her in the eye, and Raven was surprised at what she saw there. Almost as if he understood, too, but she couldn't believe that. He was the worst of them all.
Don't you have something to say? Some baseball analogy to help explain things to stupid little me?
He just looked at her for several long moments.
Yes, I have something to say, to ask you, rather. What?
Jason looked at the floor, then up again, and then she couldn't read the look in his eyes at all.
Pray for him? You and Gertie, please pray for him.
She was floored. And as if the breath had been sucked out of her, Raven's mouth opened and closed three times, and nothing came out. Her mind whirled.
He had listened some that night? What did it mean, wanting her to pray? What was behind his words? Contempt? Anger? Hope?
In the end, she could do nothing more than turn on her heel and run from them all, out of the waiting room and blindly down hospital corridors until she found a quiet, solitary place to collapse into a chair, put her face in her hands, and weep with the utter madness of it all. Chapter 13. DG was in the middle of a stirring pep talk, warming to his subject with practiced vigor.
Maybe we had to pull out all the stops to clinch the pennant, boys, but you've seen the kind of competition the Mets will be giving us, and I know that we've got this sewn up right out of the bag. Who's with me?
A rousing cheer swept the room, which was not surprising, Dennis G. being a better speaker than he knew. It didn't hurt that Bud Triplehorn was sitting in the front row, for all intents and purposes, completely whole. That didn't hurt at all.
We're clicking like never before. We've managed to really start working like a team, and tonight is the beginning of legend, folks. The beginning of a World Series victory for the National League certified since 1903 Boston Braves. How about that?
The cheer doubled and redoubled, and as DG began walking the length of the room, shaking each player's hand in turn, the sheer excitement running around threatened to overwhelm them all. Finally, he got back to the front, held his hands up for quiet.
Now, I've kept a sharp eye on this team, and I know that you turkeys have your positions down. We're clicking, we're tight, and there's nothing I need to do now but sit back and watch the magic happen. So get out of here, he waved at them all. Go be kind to your wives, kiss your girlfriends, wash the dog, or do something constructive with your Monday morning, but be here nice and sharp at 4 o'clock, understand? Anybody late has to play naked. Don't think I'm kidding,
the manager of the Braves called over the laughter and chair scraping as his boys began exiting the room. Standing back as the place emptied, DG watched carefully, and he saw a group of men that were ready. God bless Stiller for making it all possible, he thought irreverently, but not without a little bit of pride. 4 games, straight out of the bag. Dennis G. had no doubts about that. It was going to be a quick week. Jason caught up to Bud in the outside corridor.
I heard what Mr. Muldowney said.
The whole room had heard, but Bud was nice enough not to rib the kid.
And I'll say that was some good news, huh?
Bud grunted, figuring he could maybe poke a little fun.
You should see it from my side.
At least Jason could laugh at himself. Yeah, sure, but I just wanted to ask for myself. You okay? Thinking about it, Triplehorn realized just how tired he was of that question. Without saying anything at first, he just flexed his arm a couple of times, stopping in mid-stride to throw several imaginary pitches.
That answer your question?
Jason looked embarrassed. Actually, Bud, I didn't mean just your arm. I was asking in general if you were okay. He looked into the kid's eyes, and then Bud understood, and was touched that alone out of all the Braves, manager included, Jason Stiller was concerned with Francis Triplehorn the person, not Francis Triplehorn the star pitcher.
Good, kid. Really good. Any day you get out of a hospital under your own power is a good day.
Great. Looked like Jason was about to leave, but Bud put out a hand and stopped him.
Listen, kid, I really appreciate your concern.
It was difficult to say, but darned if he wasn't going to say it.
And don't think I ain't happy that you saved my life. I don't know where that monster came from. Come to think of it, I don't know where he went, either. But you showed up in the nick of time, kid, and I'm mighty glad of it.
Jason looked freshly embarrassed, but they shook on it, and he nodded, and then strode off down the hall, his head up proudly. Bud hid a chuckle behind his hand. That boy was all right. And it was going to be fun to watch him whoop up on the Mets, that was for sure. Jason's happy stride was knocked for a loop as he swung cleanly through the door exiting the stadium and saw Raven Germain standing by the ticket kiosk waiting for him. She was nice enough not to say anything about how he almost ran into the wall. After he had recovered his balance and his courage, he walked to where she was. Morning.
Hi.
Whether it was on purpose or not, she was wearing the same overalls and ponytail that he remembered from that day so long before. The day of the kiss. Why did she have to be so beautiful anyway? Why couldn't he just give his heart a swift kick in the butt and move on?
I guess Bud is okay?
That's what he says. Seems glad to be out of the hospital.
Are you excited about the series?
Sure, I guess. It's just another set of games, though, in the end.
Uh-huh.
She looked uncomfortable, and Jason felt like an idiot. This was the same woman that he had told his deepest fears to. The woman who had listened to all of his stories and his dreams. Why could he no longer speak to her?
Are you okay?
When you ran out of that hospital room the other day, I wanted to run after you. She wished he had, and also wished that they could figure out what the barrier was between them and knock it the heck down.
I'm okay. I still don't understand all of this. I don't get how this game you all play is more important than the people that care about you, more important than your own health, even.
She kept going before he could interrupt.
But it's probably not something I'm made to understand. And that doesn't mean it's wrong. It doesn't mean any of you were wrong.
The next thing she said was not planned, coming as it did from the depths of her heart.
Are you aware that I'm still in love with you?
Ooh, she hadn't meant to say that. How it could keep from making things worse, she did not know. But the next step was up to him, wasn't it? The breath in his throat refused to move either forward or back, until with an effort he made his heart accept it, let the information in, despite all the sudden fears and desires that sprang up along the way.
Raven.
Jason knew he was still in love, too, and without letting himself think, he slowly, letting her pull back if she wished, desiring not to frighten or anger her, he stepped forward once, and again, and then she was in his arms. It was as if the flimsiest, silkiest magical spell had been woven around their embrace. He couldn't bring himself to say anything, to do anything more, for fear that it would all evaporate if he so much as blinked. For more than a moment, Jason Stiller concentrated on the feel and smell of her, aware that this moment was virtually stolen, and he might never be so fortunate again in his life. For once, he would not take his good fortune for granted, and if this was somehow the end, he wanted to remember it forever. To remember her forever. She hadn't expected her confession, hadn't even known that it was true until the words had appeared, And then when he stepped forward, she knew the smartest thing would be to stop him, to move away or say no. But it just seemed so right. When his arms were tight around her, when she could just lay her head up under his chin, feel his breath on her cheek, it felt like all was right with the world and nothing could get in to harm her again. Except that it wasn't true, and she knew that. She couldn't trust in her feelings, and as nice as this was, it wouldn't take care of the problems in life. It wouldn't make her father's anger go away. Plus, there was another thing. Another important thing that had to be resolved, or even being held by him, was wrong. Jason? He was almost shaking, at once overwhelmed with his love and yearning for the beautiful woman in his arms. And scared, scared badly that he was about to wake up and she would be gone. Yes? There's something I have to ask you. She didn't sound especially excited over what she had to say, but she wasn't pushing back from him either. What is that? Then she did push back, just a little, stepping slightly away, far enough to look him straight in the eye. I need you to tell me the truth, Jason, even if you don't think I'll like it. Now the fears were doubled, and he didn't think he wanted this to continue. But in the end, he loved her, truly loved her, and knew that whatever the question was, it was important. You have my word. She looked into those brown eyes and knew she could accept that. Before I forget, I'm sorry that I didn't listen to you last week. The argument we had, it was at least partly my fault, if not mostly. You wanted to talk about us, and I wouldn't listen. At first it looked like Jason had something to say, but by the time she was finished, he was still again. So she continued. I thought about us, Jason, just as much in the last week as in the last month. Had it been that long since things had gone sour? And if it were up to me alone, if I could make all my decisions just based on what I want, what I think is best for me, then I would want to let you hold me, would want to just go away with you, wherever you went in this world. She couldn't believe the thing she was saying. Was it something in the air? But her conscience told her it was all true, and maybe it was necessary. Maybe if she laid it all out, he would finally deal with it all. I'm old enough, and I think wise enough to say it. If it were up to me, I would marry you, Jason Stiller, if you'd have me. Her voice faltered for a moment, and there was only silence. Either he realized that she wasn't finished, or he didn't have anything to say, because he didn't break the silence. But it's not up to me, Jason. What I was trying to tell you the other day, what you didn't want to listen to, was true, and very, very important to me. Raven did not have any idea how he would take it, what his response would be. She had to trust the one who had said he would make everything okay. A lightning-quick prayer, basically an anxious, Jesus, please help, and she went on. I've given my heart, my life, over to Jesus Christ. I love him, and the man I would marry has to understand that I'm always going to love Jesus more than I will him. There's more. The man I would marry has to be able to say the same thing. He has to be on the same team, Jason, and in agreement with me that he will always love Jesus more than me. I've seen what marriage is like. Even the strong ones don't have things easy, and there's just no other way. For no special reason, she suddenly felt embarrassed, but didn't stop. What I'm saying, and I hope it's making some sort of sense, is that unless you also serve Jesus, unless you have a relationship with him as well, I just can't give you my heart, Jason. As much as I love you, as much as I enjoy being around you, as scared as I get sometimes thinking about it, worried that I'll never find anybody as wonderful as you. Gertie showed me where the Bible talks about marriage, and God doesn't appreciate people that love him marrying people that don't. It was all the marriage discussion that was making her embarrassed. The kid probably didn't have any plans that serious, probably just wanted to take her out and kiss her and have a good time. Now she was running him off. Out of words, out of pleas, Raven just stopped talking and watched him. He had almost gotten stuck on hearing that she was willing and seemed like she actually wanted to marry him. It was something Jason had thought of more than a few times, had daydreamed about, wondering if it were possible that a girl, especially a woman such as Raven Germain, would ever desire to commit her whole life to him. He almost got stuck on that part. But he heard it all, and because he knew how sincere she was being, knew that whether or not he liked it, whether or not it got him what he wanted, he could not lie to her. I respect and love you, Raven, and part of me wishes desperately that I had good things to tell you. I know who Jesus supposedly is, Raven. I know all the stories. I spent many hours, a long time ago, sitting in Sunday morning church. I know how the tale goes. She could read it in his eyes, but needed to hear it said. He said it. But I don't have anything to do with God, not since my mother died. You don't know my father. You don't know how cold and uncaring he is. God is the same way, and I can't trust that. Strangely, she didn't feel like crying. The sadness inside wasn't despair, wasn't the utter heartbreak it might have once been. It was just sadness, for his being lost in the world, and for all the love she had for him that apparently was still not going to be enough. Then you'd better stop touching me. He did, and she stepped away completely, turning her back. It's not that I don't want it, Jason, but... I know. He sounded sad, too. In the end, her Lord still loved her, and that was what really mattered. Yet her heart felt awful as she walked away, not letting herself look back, hoping somehow to trust him through it all. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding, she quoted to herself. Without asking her permission, her heart yelled suddenly, made her turn around and look back to where he was. But he wasn't there anymore, and she was alone. Jason Stiller hadn't been telling everybody the truth. It wasn't just a bunch of games. It was the World Series. But he couldn't act out the excitement he truly felt, because it might bring bad luck, it might make him look foolish, and it certainly wouldn't help him relax and just do his best. His head knew the Mets were not much of a challenge, nothing like the Reds had been. His head knew that this surely would be a cakewalk, and the thousands of people watching and thousands more listening over radio waves would get to hear about his heroic deeds, about more home runs and high scores, and maybe the magic number 400. His head knew it, but for some reason the rest of him had not gotten the message, and as Jason walked towards home plate for his first at bat, his hands were shaking. Everything fell into place, though, as soon as he was in the right spot. Just to the left of and slightly behind the plate, bat resting easily on his shoulder, as he looked Shady Jeffries, pitching for the New York Mets, right in the eye. The first pitch came down the alley, and with his usual grace and ease, Jason swatted it completely out of the park. DG had been watching closely, having heard Jason talk about how easy things would be, and at the same time, knowing the kid pretty well, seeing the shaky hands, seeing less than a usual bounce to his friend's step. Dennis G knew perfectly well that it wasn't just another game, despite what anybody bravely said. The sound of that first home run. He did indeed believe, once again, that everything was going to turn out all right. If it wasn't his own dream, and never would be, at least he was close enough to hear the applause, feel the glory being handed down. And that was better than a poke in the eye with a rusty nail, wasn't it? Bud Triplehorn grinned from where he was watching in the dugout. If that boy's batting wasn't the prettiest sight he had almost ever seen. And the fact that the ball never hit the ground, well, that didn't hurt anything. After a few practice throws, and despite a week of working hard and wringing every ounce of strength and speed out of his so recently injured arm, Bud knew the truth. The truth that he had not and would not share with anybody, not if he could help it. The long-feared injury had happened, and his career, his status as a Boston Brave, now depended entirely on Jason Stiller. Because as long as the kid was working miracles, nobody would notice a washed-up pitcher without an arm. Or so he hoped. Bud sat in the dugout thinking about the end of his dreams, wondering why he hadn't done a better job of holding on to the goodness that had been. There had been so many years of applause, of winning, of all the goodies that went along with being people's hero. Where had it gone? Why had it never been enough? He sat and thought about it, and for no particular reason his perspective changed. Then again, there was something to be said for actually letting it go, being thankful for his wife, his family, the success of the past, and saying goodbye to the greatest sport on earth, truly being free to be who he was. Bud sat in the dugout wondering if such a thing was humanly possible, even as his friend and teammate began to trot around the baseline. Robert P. Germain had been doing a lot of thinking. He hadn't seen much of Raven the past month, and he sat in the stadium box and wondered about that, while keeping a close eye on the man she had claimed to love. He knew about love. He knew how dangerous love was, how painful. He knew what was best, that security and something to hold onto was worth a lot more than feelings, however nice they might be. That was why money meant so much to him. You could hold on to money. It had weight. It had a feel to it. And if that feeling was cold, uncaring, at least it was real. At least it was real. In the end, Robert Germain had figured out a way to get more of what he wanted most. And after talking with the owner of the New York Mets, a deal had been struck that would let him rake in a whole pile of the cold, uncaring safety blanket that meant so much to him. And in the end, when everything was said and done, Raven would be matched up with a man she could trust. One of his choosing, or one under his control. Either way, she would be safe. Robert P. Germain kept a close eye on Jason Stiller, cooked his plans, and reveled in the peace that he felt deep inside. Raven was not sitting in a nice box with her father. That wasn't where she wanted to be. Neither was she sitting in or near the dugout, as much as Jason and Deej might have enjoyed it. She had been invited by both separately. She didn't really belong there, either. Raven Germain didn't know where she fit in, or what to cling to, except for the small voice in her spirit that kept calling her back, away from the easy outs and shortcuts the world kept offering. Depression, anger, the solace of alcohol, or money, her father's comfort, or even another relationship, finding another handsome man to hold her and tell her he loved her. The small voice wouldn't let her get away with that anymore, and while she appreciated his help, in the end she still had to consciously decide to trust. But every time she did, the voice congratulated her on making a good choice, reminded her to keep trusting, and promised again that everything would be okay. Not that trusting was easy. Not when it seemed impossible that the man she loved would ever let his heart be unfrozen, be melted by the love of her Lord. Not when she had to push her heart away from him over and over. Nor when her father had begun to earnestly seek out a suitable husband for his only daughter. Well, Raven knew what was going on, though Robert P. hadn't bothered to tell her. She knew him, and was good at piecing things together. He was going to marry her off, just as soon as he found a worthy, respectable and very rich, man to sell her to. Raven was no wallflower. She had a mind and a will of her own. But how could she get away from it? Simply refuse? Run? Her father had more control over her life than she was really willing to admit, and to top it all off, every time she turned to her Lord for help, he just told her to trust him and not worry. Sometimes the young lady felt like screaming or throwing plates, but she had learned that she could be better than such things, and she wanted that. So she watched the game progress from her quiet, anonymous seat, crying a little and doing her best not to worry as she watched the man she loved win the day. The National League certified since 1903 Boston Braves won the first game of the World Series, and the next day they won the second, and the next day they won the third. Despite winning their own division, the Mets looked terrible. People who didn't really know what they were talking about said that New York had a fair amount of skill, but that it was pretty much luck that had gotten them the pennant. They didn't have what it took to win a series. Not that anybody imagined that things would be the same, if not for the kid. Oh, he had signed autographs before, but now it was necessary to travel in groups with his teammates, just so the guys could help him keep moving, if nothing else, simply carry his bags so he could sign pennants on the go. Everybody that came around wanted to shake his hand, to congratulate him on the runs, on the scores, on the record-setting average. It was embarrassing, and the Braves who helped the kid out during that show-stopping week remembered later that Jason had always thanked them, usually blushing as he did so, for helping out. That humility, and the fact that the Braves knew Jason really was hitting for them all, kept more than one player from walking out in frustration. But the team stuck together, and were more than fired up for their fourth day, for what all but the most diehard Met fans were sure would be the final game of that unforgettable World Series. The most diehard Mets fans, and Robert P. Germain. There was an emergency meeting in his office directly after Game 3, in which Bob decided he'd like to speak with D.G. Muldowney, Bud Triplehorn, and Jason Stiller.
Well, we've got an injured Bud Triplehorn. We've got Raven and Jason unable to connect over that very important subject. And to top it all off, Bob Germain wants to tell the boys something. Yeah, hopefully there was enough foreshadowing that it's not going to surprise you when I say that what he wants to tell them is not good news. And if you remember some episodes ago when we first started into this kid journey together, I told you that there's a plot twist that I had completely forgotten about. Well, next chapter, chapter 14, is where that plot twist is revealed. So it's a doozy. And you definitely want to come back in about 2 weeks and see what is up with that. Although, by the time that podcast airs, it probably, hopefully, will be the entire book, The Kid, will be available on Amazon. So if you want to keep an eye out for The Kid on Amazon.com, the print version or the MP3 recorded version that you've been listening to pieces of, or the buy it and have a book in your hands version, all of those should be available before August, or at least slightly into August, certainly before the next podcast airs. That is my goal. So, The Kid by Will Nestle. That's N as in Nancy, U-E-S-S-L-E. Look for it at an online retailer near you, because if you have an online connection, everything's near you. That's why the internet is so great. Anyway, I'm going to stop yakking, let you go back to your life, but do me a favor, own your stage, all right? Promise? All right, I think I heard your promise. Look forward to hearing about that. See you back here in a couple weeks.